KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. The House barely passed a budget framework calling to cut taxes and also restrain spending. We hear from Tim Burchett of Tennessee, who was close to voting no and switched to yes. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Bird flu is spreading, with one person so far dying from the disease. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Layla Faldin, but there's a deep divide among meat and egg farmers about what should be done to keep birds and people safe. Also, some trans, non-binary, and intersex Americans say the genders listed on their new passports conflict with other legal documents. And a gospel star makes a temporary switch to R&B. It's Wednesday, February 26th. On this day in 1993, a truck bomb at the World Trade Center killed six people. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Last night, House Republicans approved the framework for a partisan budget plan that backs President Trump's domestic agenda. NPR's Claudia Grisales reports.
The budget framework unlocks the next steps for Republican-led committees to piece together the details for the sweeping multi-trillion-dollar plan. The partisan plan will address immigration, tax, defense, and energy policy, as well as extend $4.5 trillion in tax cuts passed under President Trump's first term. It also aims to cut $2 trillion in federal spending, which could lead to more than $800 billion in cuts to major U.S. health programs such as Medicaid. The lone Republican to vote no on the plan, Kentucky's Thomas Massey, argued the GOP effort will add $20 trillion to the U.S. debt. Claudia Grisales, NPR News.
President Trump holds his first cabinet meeting today with his secretaries since taking office. NPR's Stephen Fowler says billionaire and special government employee Elon Musk is supposed to attend.
This cabinet meeting is going to be worth watching because it's one of the first major public sources of tension between the Trump administration and the implementation of Musk's Doge effort. But there's some other simmering conflicts in the background. Many of the actions that Musk and Doge have taken are in court after running afoul of very particular and explicit set of rules and laws that govern the government.
NPR's Stephen Fowler reporting. President Trump has ordered an investigation into another imported metal, copper. Trump's executive order suggests he may consider new tariffs on copper. This comes as Trump's tariffs on imported aluminum and steel are supposed to take effect in mid-March. Trump says his decision to levy a 25% tariff on imports from Canada and Mexico will go ahead next week. It's not clear if negotiations might delay any of these. The White House decision to handpick which news outlets cover the president is being met with swift backlash from members of the press. NPR's Windsor Johnston reports the administration says going forward it will choose its own press pool, breaking decades of precedent.
The White House Correspondents Association, a group that represents reporters who cover the administration, has long determined on its own which journalists take part in the daily pool. Eugene Daniels, the president of the organization, spoke to NPR about the White House decision.
In free countries like the United States is, leaders don't get to pick the people who cover them day in and day out. The WHCA, our job has been for many, many years to not keep people out. We consistently bring new organizations in.
The administration says the move would be more inclusive and restore access back to the American people who elected President Trump.
Windsor Johnston reporting. This is NPR. There was a near miss yesterday between two planes at Chicago's Midway Airport. A private jet entered a runway as a Southwest Airlines passenger jet was preparing to land. The Southwest jet pilot was able to pull up, narrowly avoiding the private jet. Separately, the New York Times reports there was a second close call yesterday morning at Reagan National Airport near Washington. One plane canceled its landing to avoid a second plane ready to take off. This is the same airport where 67 people were killed when two aircraft collided last month. A new study shows more children are engaging in screen time at younger ages. NPR's Katie Riddle reports.
The report shows that 40% of children now have their own tablet by the time they are just 2 years old. Jim Steyer is the CEO of Common Sense Media. That's the group that published this data. He says parents can safely manage screen time.
There's a very important point to say here, which is this is not about demonizing technology. It's just about understanding how profoundly different childhood looks today compared to just a few years ago.
One of his recommendations, know what kind of media your kids are consuming and make sure it's healthy. Katie Riddle, NPR News.
Utah's governor is considering whether to sign a bill banning fluoride in public water systems. New federal health secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. claims without evidence it's associated with disease. Public health officials say no. Fluoride is often the only preventative dental care that some people receive. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, supporting books, radio, podcasts, film, television, theater, and more to bridge science and the humanities. And the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. Coming up, how does President Trump's approach to Europe and Russia look to a former advisor?
But first, House Republicans barely passed a budget framework last night with instructions for committees to write bills that advance President Trump's agenda on the border, $2 trillion in spending cuts, and $4.5 trillion in tax cuts over 10 years. There's still a long road ahead to make these cuts a reality. Even getting here was tough. Some Republican lawmakers worried the cuts would hurt constituents, specifically around proposed cuts to Medicare. Other Republican lawmakers questioned whether this went deep enough. After the president made a round of phone calls, the measure wound up passing by a vote of 217 to 215. Republican Representative Tim Burchett joins me now. He's from Tennessee to talk about this. Good morning.
Thank you so much for having me on, ma'am.
Thank you for being here. Congressman, there wasn't a vote to spare here, so your vote on this resolution was really important. You were a no, and after a phone call from the president, you got to yes. What changed that got you to a yes?
Just the talk about what was, you know, my priorities. I favor tax cuts. I favor a closed border and reduced regulation. I think if all those are combined and in the perfect world, we'd be back on track. The problem is it's Washington, ma'am, and it's not a very perfect world. It's a dishonest community at its core. And, you know, and this is the best I could get to. I've often said you're either at the table or on the menu, and I needed to be at the table. And I talked to the president at length. He listened to my concerns about my priorities as an American, as a Tennessean, and where we need to go, and
what are your main concerns? I mean, what are your main concerns, that this didn't go far enough in its cuts?
Yes, ma'am. I'm afraid we're $36 trillion in debt, and I think I don't even look at Medicaid and Medicare. There's that we don't. That's not even in there. That's a misconception that keeps getting put out.
But there, the proposal does include $880 billion of cuts to a committee that handles healthcare spending, including Medicaid.
Yeah, to the committee, yes, ma'am. But that committee will decide how that is done. And as years passed, I can remember when President Reagan was. And thank you for bringing that up. I can remember when President Reagan was in, and he there was a delivery service of. It was for every dollar that was distributed, it cost a dollar to a dollar and a half to get it to these people. And he cut that distributor, he cut that middleman, so to speak, out. And that's a lot of what we're going to do. And, of course, we're finding so much fraud, waste, and abuse in these groups.
Is there evidence of that fraud and abuse that can be shared with the public?
Yeah, well, we are getting ready to delve into it, but there is where there's overbilling, there's phantom accounts, there's things like that, and just general mismanagement that you see, that you see that in business, ma'am. I mean, in private business, that they have to. I have a friend who took over a very large distributorship at another end of the state, and they went in and they had almost a third of the employees were ghost employees, and this was a very well established and a very successful business.
So what I think I hear you saying is that this $880 billion of proposed cuts that people believe will hit Medicaid, you're saying it won't hurt people's coverage, because that's really important to constituents.
No, ma'am. Yeah, I believe that is exactly what I'm saying, ma'am. That is exactly what I'm saying, and in politics.
But that's a lot of money for it not to hit the actual health care coverage.
Ma'am, when you find $3 trillion that there's no paper trail in government, that is not a whole lot of money. It is a whole lot of money to a Tennessean, to the average American. Yes, it is. It's a whole heck of a lot of money, but we're finding that over and over and over again that there is waste, fraud, and abuse, and that's just the bottom line. And people don't like to admit to it, but it's the truth, and it's both parties. We've had this thing. Go ahead.
I just wanted to ask, this is just a framework, so it's really just a start, including writing the actual bill is still to come. And we've already heard from some of your Senate Republican colleagues that they're concerned around deep cuts to Medicaid.
Sure.
I mean, will you be able to persuade them to get behind these measures?
I don't know. I can't speak for them, but honestly, I think America is tired of the waste, and they've seen it in so many departments, and they're just tired of the way this thing's going. And if we can take the money out of the bureaucrats' hands and from some fraud or waste and put it back in the pockets of Americans, I think that's a very good thing. And I think we can do that in an efficient manner and not hurt anyone.
That's Republican Representative Tim Burchett of Tennessee. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, ma'am. It's been an honor.
We've been working to make sense of President Trump's foreign policy approach. In recent days, the president has attacked allies and seemingly embraced a longtime antagonist, publicly criticizing and making demands of Ukraine's president while declining, when asked, to criticize Russian President Vladimir Putin, beginning negotiations with Putin over ending the war in Ukraine. We've heard analysts say that Trump seems to have switched sides in Europe. And Vice President J.D. Vance actually told Europeans their real threat is not Russia, but the threat from within their own countries. Victoria Coates is following all of this. She is at the Heritage Foundation and was Deputy National Security Advisor in the first Trump administration. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Steve. Good to be with you.
So we'll remind people there has been this world order, particularly in Europe, ever since World War II, 80 years now, almost exactly. The U.S. leads its European allies when necessary against Russia. That was the form in the early years of the war in Ukraine. Do you believe the president has upended the world order or switched sides?
No, I don't think so, Steve. I think what President Trump is doing is acknowledging that 80 years on, the reason that some of the structures were put in place after World War II, which was actually largely to prevent another inter-Europe war,
mm-hmm.
that those circumstances are no longer in place. You know, a war between Germany and France is not our number one national security problem. Neither is it Europe. And so I think he is looking at the world and saying, well, okay, there is a war in Europe, but, you know, this is the Ukraine-Russia war. It's been going on for 3 years. There's been no diplomacy to proceed to a conclusion of the war. We've had a lot of maximalist rhetoric. We've had a lot of sort of displays mm-hmm. of support for Ukraine and declarations that Ukraine is a democracy and this is an existential threat to the West. But we've also had hundreds of thousands dead and a lot of destruction. And as I said, no progress. So mm-hmm. I think he's trying to change that paradigm. Also, I mean,
if I can just ask, you mentioned that a lot of the structures were put together to avoid an inter-European war. I think that's correct. But NATO specifically was an alliance against the expansion of what was then the Soviet Union, what is now Russia, which does seem to literally be the problem right now. It's not just a war between Ukraine and Russia. Russia invaded Ukraine.
Well, it is. And it's sort of interesting to me to look at, you know, something like the United Kingdom, and we'll be welcoming the Prime Minister Starmer, to Washington this week. We've already had President Macron. We will have President Zelensky. So that hardly looks to me like, you know, a Washington that is rejecting Europe. We're going to have three heads of state this week alone coming to visit. And the issue with NATO, of course, is last year at the NATO summit here in Washington, the NATO countries collectively agreed on a series of war plans that we would execute in the event of an additional kinetic action mm-hmm. by an enemy. And those war plans, Steve, require NATO to be investing collectively, all of us, at 3.5%, which is where the United States are, mm-hmm. is rather. And, you know, you had the UK announce this week with great fanfare they were going to try to get to 2.5. That math just doesn't add up. And so if 3 years into a war in Europe, you don't have the major European economies getting to the level of defense expenditure they need to get to mm-hmm. in order to, you know, sustain what NATO has agreed to, you know, then I have to wonder if it's not the United States that's turning its back on NATO. It's these other NATO members who aren't investing.
I'll just remind people, when you say 2.5, 3.5, we're talking about a percentage of GDP, and everyone would like it to be higher in theory, although some nations haven't done it. Other nations in NATO, by the way, have. I just want to ask about the concessions that the United States has offered to Russia's Vladimir Putin as the president tries to end this war. Michael McFaul, who's a critic of Trump, former U.S. ambassador there, notes that the U.S. has already publicly said that Ukraine has to give up territory to Russia, that Ukraine can't join NATO, that the U.S. won't send peacekeeping troops, that the U.S. will reduce the number of soldiers in Europe, and that even Vladimir Zelensky, the Ukrainian president, has to hold elections before their peace negotiations and other concessions. And in McFaul's view, the United States hasn't demanded anything of Russia. Is that how you see it?
Not at all. I mean, I think what has been, if you want to call it offered to Russia, has largely been rhetorical. None of this has cost the president anything. I would add the United Nations General Assembly resolution to that list because, off the top of my head, I can't think of anything more useless than one of those resolutions.
Oh, you think it doesn't matter that this resolution with the wording that few people other than the United States agreed with passed? Okay, go on.
This has largely been rhetorical. And what we've offered Ukraine, on the other hand, which will be signed at the White House on Friday, is a material economic deal that will invest the United States in Ukraine and in Ukraine's security. So I would see that as a much more serious offer than, you know, rhetoric or ungers.
And in about 10 seconds, do you think that deal would commit the United States to defend Ukraine against Russia?
I think it gives the United States a vested interest in Ukraine, which is something we have not had before. So we will see what that results in.
Victoria Coates is a former Deputy National Security Advisor during President Trump's first term and is now at the Heritage Foundation. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Steve.
This is NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency has eliminated the jobs of thousands of government employees and left many more uncertain about their positions. We'll talk with Harvard Professor of Public Policy Elizabeth Linos about what that means for federal workers and the rest of us who depend on government services. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Viking, dedicated to creating travel experiences for the thinking person with programs designed for cultural enrichment on board and on shore. Learn more at Viking.com. From Moderna, committed to protecting people from COVID-19. The CDC recommends getting a second dose of this season's COVID-19 vaccine for those 65 and older. Doctors can advise about getting a second dose. From Progressive Insurance, Progressive is looking for dedicated and forward-thinking individuals to join their growing team. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin. By the time Marvin Sapp was 10 years old, he was singing all the time. He sang in church, he sang R&B with his buddies, but then his mother told him he had to make a choice.
And she said to me, she said, you can sing in the church or in the world, you can't do both. And I chose to sing gospel music.
It was a good choice. For decades, Marvin Sapp has been one of the most admired and successful gospel singers in the country. So it raised more than a few eyebrows when, a few weeks ago, he released an R&B album.
Why would it make sense not to listen to your heart?
This is one of the songs on the new Marvin Sapp album, If I Were an R&B Singer. So that made me think of what his mom told him all those years ago.
Why can't you sing gospel and secular music at the same time? I mean, I'm thinking Aretha Franklin.
I probably could have, but I guess my mentality, my mindset has always been, honestly, that when you do music, you have to have a specific conviction that goes along with it. And if you don't have that conviction, you can't convey it properly.
Also, you were 10.
I was 10, yeah.
It was kind of hard to go against mom at 10.
You know, I never thought about that. You know, absolutely. But the fact that she gave me the option.
So one of the reasons we're talking to you now is that you actually, on Valentine's Day, delivered what for a lot of people was a surprise.
Yeah, it was a shock.
It is an R&B EP.
Yeah.
So why are you going against mom's wishes now?
Well, you know, I don't know if I'm necessarily going against mom's wishes. I think for years, people have always asked me, you know, why I haven't seen R&B. And I would just tell them, I say, that's not really my passion. And after being asked for so many years, I finally just said, after sitting down honestly with my son and with one of his good friends who actually produced it, Colton, I actually said, you know what? People have been asking me forever and a day, you know, what would I actually sound like singing R&B? So I decided to give them what they've been asking for.
Whenever you need someone, you can count on me. 'Cause you've been by my side every time I need you. Never falling off when we disagree. 'Cause iron sharpens iron, babe, you sharpen me up.
First of all, I was curious about which song came to you first.
Oh, that's easy.
Which one?
Free Falling. Because my son and Colton wrote it together. And when they presented it to me, I was like, oh wow, this is deep.
There are strains of sadness in that song.
Yeah.
And we can talk about what you bring to it if you don't mind.
Well, you know, I think I was married for 18 years. And
you lost your wife.
My wife went on to be with the Lord. She transitioned from this life to life eternal some 14, almost 15
yeah,
years
ago. Yeah, in 2010.
Yeah. And
from cancer, as
yeah,
I understand.
From cancer,
I'm so sorry
cancer.
For your loss,
yeah,
if I may.
Thank you. And I met her in the third grade. And we went to elementary school, middle school, high school. And when she transitioned, I was like, wow, you know, what am I going to do? Because I got three kids. They were all preteen and teenagers, and I really dedicated and focused my life to raising them. And listening to that song when I first heard it and even began to help them write it, I literally began to reflect on what happened for me and how it was when their mother and I were together.
You show me what love is.
You know, one of the songs for which you're most famous, a gospel song, again, is Here I Am.
Oh, yeah.
It's a three-tissue one for me.
It's a three-tissue? Okay.
It's a three-tissue one for me.
There were times when I almost gave and I've cried. I said, Lord, it's too much.
And I thought mistakenly that you wrote that after you lost your wife.
No.
But you didn't. You wrote it before. You released it almost a year before.
Yeah.
And I was just wondering what gave you that insight into grief.
Well, you know, when the song, myself and Jonathan Dunn, who is, you know, actually the chief writer of that song, when he presented it to me and we listened to it and really kind of reworked it, lyrically, it was just amazing. Honestly, this was Melinda's favorite song. A year before even she passed away, she would listen to it all the time, you know, because she was going through chemo and going through the whole process of fighting for her life.
But here I am, I'm still standing. Here I am, after all I've been through, I survived.
You know, going through cancer, it's one thing for you to go through it as an individual. It's another thing for you to have a mate who is helpless and can't do anything but be there. You know, when you're a man, your purpose as a husband is to be the protector, the provider, that individual who's supposed to fix it. And when you can't fix it, you feel inadequate. But she would play that song, Here I Am, I'm Still Standing. And I was like, wow, you know, the fact that you're going through what you're going through and you're able to declare and decree that you're not going to allow what's happening to you to destroy you, but you're going to stand in it. I thought that was powerful.
Mm. Why are you trying to break me so early in the morning? I'm like, I'm barely holding on here.
I'm sorry. You brought the preacher here. That's the problem. You brought
the preacher to do it.
Yeah.
Because it's high, but we're feeling inside. But the question is this for a moment or a lifetime?
You've sort of suggested that this R&B album is the one and done, right?
Oh, yeah, I didn't suggest it.
Why?
That's
you
it.
Said, I know. Why?
Oh, no.
Why?
You know, because it was...
Why?
I took the risk, and I put out something that I kind of felt like it was like a bucket list thing. It was kind of like, it ain't that I can't do it. I could do it, but this is not my call. So it's just a great blessing for me to be able to try something different. I thought I had something to say, so I said it.
Bishop Marvin Sapp, his new album is called If I Were an R&B Singer. Bishop Sapp, thank you so much for stopping by.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
I'd rather take my time, take it easy.
Marvin Sapp dropped by NPR's offices to record a Tiny Desk concert. That should be out in the world by the end of the week. This is NPR News.
Quick, what's 3 plus 9? Oh, that's too easy for you? Okay, what about 3 minus the root of 2,950? Well, even if you can solve that problem, you probably can't do it as fast as 14-year-old world record holder Arun Shukla. For him, numbers are a game.
I love playing with numbers.
I'm Ari Shapiro. We meet the human calculator on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky says Kyiv has agreed to a framework economic deal with the U.S. Speaking today in Kyiv, Zelensky said security guarantees are still being negotiated. Zelensky is expected in Washington on Friday for talks with President Trump. Ukraine's prime minister says the economic deal includes U.S. access to Ukraine's rare earth minerals. The Trump administration is trying to negotiate an end to Russia's war against Ukraine. House Speaker Mike Johnson is applauding the House for approving a budget measure that funds President Trump's legislative priorities. It includes $100 billion for immigration enforcement and the Pentagon. NPR's Claudia Grisales has more.
And there's a lot of big numbers here. For one, it calls for $4.5 trillion in tax cuts. That's tied to an extension of the 2017 Trump tax cuts that are expiring at the end of the year. And then campaign promises are also included in this plan that Trump made about eliminating taxes on tips. It also calls for $2 trillion in cuts to federal spending that would dramatically reshape the federal budget.
That budget measure narrowly passed. Republicans in the Senate support a scaled-back spending plan with tax cuts dealt separately. This is NPR News. Health officials in West Texas say a measles outbreak there continues to spread across 9 counties. The number of confirmed cases is up to at least 124. Some of those infected are hospitalized. The vast majority of measles cases are in those ages 18 and younger. It's the largest outbreak of the disease in Texas in nearly 30 years. A new study shows a decline in cancer death rates among Black Americans over the last 30 years. Scott Massioni with member station WYPR reports.
The study from the American Cancer Society found that cancer death rates for Black men fell nearly 50% since 1991. For Black women, the rate dropped 33%. The study credits a decrease in smoking for the improvement, as well as better cancer treatment and screening methods. Still, Black Americans continue to have higher cancer mortality rates than their white counterparts. The disparities stem from inequalities in health that trace back to structural racism, according to the authors of the study. Those disparities include differences in medical access, socioeconomic status, and insurance coverage. For NPR News, I'm Scott Massioni in Baltimore.
Energy giant BP says it plans to ramp up its oil and gas production and scale back its spending on environmental projects. The announcement by the British company came ahead of today's shareholders meeting in London. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all, on the web at theschmidt.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Faldin. Good morning. Dozens of people in the U.S., mostly farm workers, have been infected with avian flu over the last year. One person who came into contact with birds died last month. Inside the poultry industry, there's a fight over how to beat back the infection. Egg producers are on one side, meat producers on the other, and human health is in the middle. Kate Wells of Michigan Public reports.
Greg Herbruck knew that 6.5 million of his chickens needed to die, and fast.
The mental toll on our team of dealing with that many dead chickens is just, I mean, you can't imagine it.
He's CEO of Herbruck's Poultry Ranch, and the cage-free laying hens mean a lot to him.
You know, they're really curious, and if you stand very still long enough, they'll land on your shoulder or your head.
Herbrooks is one of the largest egg producers in the U.S. It's headquartered in Michigan with these rows and rows of massive tan barns that you pass along the state highway. Last April, three of Herbrooks sites tested positive for bird flu, one right after the other.
Our vice president of production came into my office and crying when he told me the third one went positive. And you don't know at that point, are we going to survive?
Big egg farms like Herbrooks have spent millions of dollars on biosecurity in the last few years, trying to keep the virus out. Everything from employees showering in and out to hosing down every vehicle that enters the property to lasers that stop infected wild birds from landing.
Dozens and dozens of practices that we have upped our game on. I don't know what else we can do.
But when the virus is detected, egg producers turn to the USDA playbook, the stamping out method. And that means euthanizing the flocks really fast, ideally within 24 to 48 hours of the virus's detection, and then quarantine, disinfecting, testing like crazy. But none of it has been enough to stop this current outbreak.
We are in a battle and losing at the moment.
David Swain is a former USDA official who has spent his career studying avian influenza. Honestly, he's kind of in awe of it.
It's an amazing virus, but the one we're battling today is unique.
Swain says in the last 60-odd years, we have had 50 outbreaks of high pathogenic avian influenza.
The other 49 were not like this one.
That's because he says this current strain is now so prevalent and widespread across the globe that you can't just stamp it out. In the last 3 years, it's spilled into more than 40 species of mammals, from dairy cows to sea lions to dolphins. And a lot of those animals migrate, which keeps the virus circulating. So if we're going to prevent a human pandemic, we need to do something different, Swain says. We need to vaccinate poultry.
It's time for the United States to really give it serious consideration.
Egg producers like Greg Herbrook are pushing hard for this, and the USDA says it is pursuing a stockpile of poultry vaccine that matches current outbreak strains. But vaccinating birds is deeply unpopular with poultry farms that raise birds for meat. John Clifford's another former USDA official, and now he is an advisor for the USA Poultry and Egg Export Council.
You've got to understand that there's $6 billion in trade every year, and we can't afford to lose those agreements if we vaccinate.
Clifford says most countries, including the U.S., do not want to buy meat that was vaccinated for bird flu because the vaccine can mask illness in birds, and countries worry that the virus could be hiding in that vaccinated meat, crossing into their borders undetected. But Clifford says there is one thing that could force a change, the virus evolving.
If humans could transmit it human to human.
The nightmare scenario, setting the stage for a pandemic.
We'd probably be pushed really, really hard, not just from the egg industry, but from the entire public health sector.
Of course, by that point, vaccinating birds might not do much good. For NPR News, I'm Kate Wells in Ann Arbor, Michigan.
The president's executive order on gender identity is affecting some Americans' travel plans. People who are trans or intersex or non-binary say they're being issued passports that do not align with their gender identity or other legal documents. Others say their applications are just on hold. NPR's Jacqueline Diaz asked about their experiences.
24-year-old Louis submitted his passport application a day after President Donald Trump was inaugurated. That same day, Trump signed an executive order mandating that the federal government recognize only two sexes, male and female.
So I was a little bit nervous about things.
You see, Louis is transmasculine. He asked us to use only his first name because he fears harassment and retaliation at work. A New York court had recently recognized his name and gender identity change, and he needed a new passport to reflect that. But when he got his new passport,
the name was changed according to the court order, but the gender marker just matched my previous passport and was not changed, even though the court order said to change it. I wasn't surprised, but it's a little disappointing.
Now he's worried about what this means. He's male presenting and his other documents say male, but his passport says something else.
Like if I travel somewhere else, is it something that will be flagged or not?
Trans people like Louis aren't the only ones facing issues getting new passports.
The changes are having a profound impact on intersex people. Those born with genitalia, chromosomes, or reproductive organs that don't fit typical definitions for males or females.
Every time you're trying to define sex in these perfectly binary terms, you're going to impact intersex people who, by definition, don't present with perfectly binary sex.
That's Erica Lorschbaugh, the executive director of Interact, a civil rights group for people with intersex traits. She's hearing from intersex people who feel at a loss.
Now folks are feeling, I think, a little more like erased.
Others are left in complete limbo. Wesley Ebling is transmasculine non-binary. Like Louis, he wanted to change the gender marker on his passport to male. He submitted it just before the inauguration.
It is currently suspended indefinitely by the State Department with the current executive order.
And he has no idea when he will get a new passport or his old documents back.
I had dreams of travel. My partner and I were planning trips later this year, which have all obviously been put on hold as they've, you know, sort of put us transgender folks on almost an informal travel ban of sorts.
A lawsuit filed by the ACLU is challenging the State Department's passport policy. It's still working its way through the courts. But for now, Louis, Wesley, and others say they will not be pushed aside and will continue to live their lives. Jacqueline Diaz, NPR News.
Now NPR has reached out to the State Department inviting comment on Wesley Ebling's case and its broader passport policy. This is NPR News.
Target and other big companies rolled back diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives, and then foot traffic fell. Next time, here and now.
From your car radio to your smart speaker, NPR meets you where you are in a lot of different ways. Now we're in your pocket. Download the NPR app today.
Good morning, I'm Leila Fadel. A man's bad hair day landed him in jail. He was detained at Cartagena's airport on his way to Amsterdam, and it wasn't his luggage that got flagged, it was his toupee. A video released by authorities shows an officer carefully removing the man's wig, and underneath the hairpiece were about a dozen packets of cocaine. Law enforcement estimate the total street value of the 220 grams seized is some $10,500. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Fisher Investments. Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. and from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Layla Faldin. In elementary school, recess used to be when you could head outside and just play. But there are rules now at most schools to ban the rougher stuff because they want kids to be safe. But some schools in Kansas are trying a new approach that lets children play more freely. Suzanne Perez of member station KMUW takes us to the playground.
The scene at Wichita's Allen Elementary School at recess time is boisterous. A lot of running, jumping, climbing, and screaming. Pretty typical for a school playground. But there's something a little different here that's hard to see right away. Principal Allison Renner says an old rule used to be no twisting or jumping off the swings. But now...
And we even see it over here. If you want to swing on your stomach, go for it. If you want to twist, go for it. And if you get dizzy afterwards, that's the natural consequence of it.
The new approach, sometimes called risky play, follows research that shows children benefit from climbing, running, and testing their physical limits. Canadian schools have advocated the practice for decades, and it's starting to catch on in the U.S. Wichita's Allen Elementary adopted the approach last year after PE teachers complained that students weren't getting enough unstructured playtime. Even recess, that sacred 20 minutes before or after lunch, had become chock full of rigid rules. Things like no going headfirst off a slide, no playing tag, no roughhousing.
It ended up being like a lot of corrections and maybe micromanaging, and it also kind of puts a damper on creative play for kids, and it also restricts some of their social interactions.
The rules were there to prevent injuries, which is a concern. Parents sometimes sue school districts if they think an accident could have been prevented with safer equipment or better supervision. So that leaves schools trying to balance playground safety against children's need to horse around. And researchers say it's a primal urge.
Risky play is a really necessary and important part of growing up and being a child.
That's psychiatrist Stuart Brown with the National Institute for Play. He says unstructured play teaches valuable skills like communication and empathy. But it happens gradually, so schools need to make it part of their regular routine. Michelle Ingenthrone is Wichita's Assistant Superintendent for Elementary Schools. She says easing up on rules during recess makes sense.
You know, I think about when I played as a kid, we just played, and if something went wrong, we just talked to each other about it, or we just went and played someplace else. And so that's what we're trying to get back to. It's human nature. It's how kids develop.
To be clear, risky play does not mean dangerous play. Equipment should be age appropriate, and teachers still monitor recess to make sure rough and tumble activities don't get out of hand. Researchers explain it this way. Kids should be kept as safe as necessary, not as safe as possible. Bumps and bruises are a natural part of childhood, and minor setbacks like falling teach kids muscle control and resilience. At Allen Elementary, some first graders are playing on slides while others set up a game of hopscotch. Recess monitor Tatiana Cook referees an impromptu foot race.
Ready, set, go!
Renner, the principal, says easing up on rules has improved recess for students and teachers.
We can enjoy the time interacting with kids and kind of celebrating the joy of kids playing instead of constantly looking and telling kids to stop, let's do this instead.
Wichita leaders say the pilot project has been successful so far at three schools. In coming years, it could be adopted district-wide. For NPR News, I'm Suzanne Perez in Wichita.
This is NPR News.
Thank you.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. The Federal Aviation Administration is looking into a near miss in Chicago. A Southwest Airlines plane coming into Midway Airport aborted its landing yesterday to avoid hitting a business jet. David Schaefer reports.
Video shows Southwest Airlines Flight 2504 coming in for a landing. The wheels are just about to touch down when the plane suddenly pulls up as a small business jet crosses the runway in front of it. Moments earlier, an air traffic controller gives taxiing instructions to the pilot of the business jet, Flight 560, as recorded by liveatc.net.
Flight 560, turn left on runway 4 left, cross runway 31 left, and hold short of runway 31 center.
The pilot is supposed to repeat the instructions back to ensure he understands, but he mixes it up.
Right, left on on 4 left, cross 1-3 center. Flight 560.
The air traffic controller immediately corrects the pilot. The pilot repeats it right this time, but he still didn't follow the instructions, forcing the Southwest jet to pull up and go around to avert what could have been a deadly crash.
Striking video, right? I mean, I think that the video is pretty compelling.
Eric Jones is an aviation professor at Lewis University outside of Chicago.
That being said, go-arounds are a very, very common procedure that pilots and flight crews train on a lot.
This incident comes after four recent aviation crashes in North America. Jones says safety investigators study every crash and close call to improve safety. And the proliferation of smartphone and security videos help too.
For us, those are evidence that we can go back and we can look forensically and scientifically what might have been happening in that instance so that we can prevent those incidents happening in the future.
And Jones says that's what makes air travel still the safest mode of transportation by far. For NPR News, I'm David Schaefer in Chicago.
In the film Anora, actor Yura Borisov plays a Russian henchman named Igor who lives with his grandmother. He's sent to bring home the reckless son of an oligarch who's eloped with a Brooklyn sex worker.
I like Anora. It's a good name.
Anora is a frontrunner at the Academy Awards with 6 nominations, including a Best Supporting Actor nod for Borisov. NPR's Mandeli Del Barco got to talk with him.
From his home in Moscow, the actor tells NPR he wanted the character to be complex, a thug with a heart.
For me, it's trying to show that someone could be rude, but at the same time very kind inside. We're all fragile and sensitive deep inside, and it's okay.
Borisov doesn't have much dialogue. Igor doesn't even appear until the middle of the film when he subdues Anora, frightened, enraged, kicking and screaming.
Do not touch me!
Before filming that scene, Borisov asked actress Mikey Madison, who plays Anora, to hit him for real, as hard as she could. I ask if it hurt.
Me? I couldn't be hurt. I'm a man.
By the end, the quiet Igor emerges as a romantic interest.
I have to thank Yura for elevating what I had on the page. People really fell in love with his character.
Anora director Sean Baker, who also wrote the screenplay, says the actor had a lot of questions before filming.
He kept on asking me, is my character a gopnik? A gopnik is like a, you know, a hoodlum. And we said, you might be perceived as a gopnik, but we actually think that, you know, you've been, because of economic reasons or whatever, forced to take certain jobs that have put you in a situation where you come across as one because you're used as the heavy. He actually was very sensitive to eventually what Igor would become in Annie's life and brought a lot of ideas to the table.
For example, Baker says Borisov suggested casting another Russian actor, Mark Eidelstein, as the oligarch's son. Baker says getting both actors to the U.S. was stressful.
We had to get a work visa, and that was a little complicated, quite honestly, especially during the war.
Baker says he wanted Borisov as his Igor after seeing him in a Finnish film at the Cannes Film Festival in 2021. In compartment number 6, Borisov plays a young coal miner traveling by train. Baker calls Borisov the Russian Ryan Gosling. The 32-year-old actor was born in a town outside Moscow to a family of engineers and doctors. Borisov says they were skeptical about him studying theater at the university.
They said, okay, are you serious? Are you crazy? It's impossible. How could you get money? You need crazy luck.
He says he promised his mother it would work out. He went from playing soldiers in state-financed projects to international art house films. He even showed off his singing chops on a Russian TV series.
All of a sudden, he was in everything, everywhere, all at once, pun intended.
Elena Satarova is an assistant professor of Slavic languages and literature at the University of Southern California. She says Borisov took on varied roles, aspiring to be a method actor. In 2020, Borisov talked about the lengths he'd go for his art in an interview with YouTuber Yuri Dude.
He said that at one point he was considering pulling out all of his teeth so that he could then use dentures for different roles. He did not end up doing it.
Now, with Anora, Borisov is the first Russian actor nominated for an Oscar since Mikhail Baryshnikov in 1977. Reaction to that news in the former Soviet Union is mixed, says Satarova.
There's obviously some excitement to see Russia in the news in a context that is not related to the war. There are people who found all of the videos featuring his family's and his friends' reactions to the nomination really heartwarming. And then there are some videos that I've seen where people express their confusion and disbelief that this is happening.
Reporters from Russia's government-run news agency TASS asked the Kremlin if Borisov's Oscar nomination signaled the end of what they framed as the West's cancellation of Russian culture. A Kremlin spokesman simply said no. Borisov says he doesn't plan to leave Russia. In fact, in his latest film, which just premiered, he portrays the famous Russian poet Alexander Pushkin. Слух обо мне пройдет по всей Руси великой. My fame, he says as Pushkin, shall spread throughout my country's realm. Borisov's own fame is spreading around the globe as the Oscars approach. Mandalit Del Barco, NPR News.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
From a dumpster issued a mango tree that stood just by the sea. There I stick with a very lovely gal, cause I was double crossing my gal. The moon and stars so very bright, and in my hands I held her very tight. I told her how much I love her, and she said the same to me.